The Cleveland Cavaliers turn a 1.8% chance into the top pick in the NBA draft. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown here with Thomas Bradley. This week we'll talk about controversial new changes to how high school sports teams are placed in Ohio.
And two people are headed to prison after stealing thousands of dollars from a high school booster club. We'll ask the state's top attorney why there isn't more oversight.
But first, as Yogi Berra would say, it was deja vu all over again in Cleveland.
The number one pick in the 2014 NBA draft goes to the Cleveland Cavaliers.
That makes the third time in 4 years that the Cavs have won the NBA's draft lottery and will have the top pick in the June 26th draft.
And I'll tell you, Thomas, the Cavs needed a home run more now than ever after the Anthony Bennett debacle. It's do or die for the Cavs. It's a really big draft.
Yeah, three times in the last 4 years. Last year they picked Anthony Bennett, which turned out to be one of the worst top picks in the NBA draft in recent history.
So far, he could not be terrible. He might not be awful, right?
He didn't give the production of you want from a first overall pick in the NBA draft.
A good analogy here is Jermaine O'Neal for the Trailblazers, and then he was better at the Pacers later in his career. He was a dumpster fire for probably three, 4 years. So Anthony Bennett has a chance, but they need to hit a home run this time.
Well, they're going to hit a home run because, quite frankly, if Anthony Bennett is in this year's draft, he gets drafted maybe 15 to 20. So the draft classes themselves are night and day. One class is just amazing, and that's this class led by Jabari Parker, Andrew Wiggins, and Joel Embiid. The guy from Australia who didn't play college basketball, Dante Exum. Any of those guys could be a top pick in this draft, and 1 through 10, 1 through 15 are just really good athletes. The Cavs are going to do well. They're going to find their guy. They should draft, in my opinion, they should draft Andrew Wiggins.
He's the surest bet, you think, at this point? Or?
He's the surest bet. Jabari Parker's going to have a great NBA career. I think Joel Embiid fills a role the Cavs need in a big man, but he's a risk. He
had the back injury. He had to sit out the entire NCAA tournament.
He could be Greg Oden.
He could be Hakeem Olajuwon is what he could be.
He could be Hakeem Olajuwon, but he could be Greg Oden, where he doesn't ever pan out. He has the best raw talent, but he has too many injury problems. So I think the surest bet, just based on how the Cavs have drafted in the past, is Andrew Wiggins.
He's a 6'8" shooting guard out of Kansas.
He's from Kansas. He's a Canadian guy.
Yeah, and he's an athlete.
He is an athlete. He's not the next LeBron James, like everyone said, but he's pretty close. He's a very good athletic player. And this brings up another point we kind of talked about last week. The Cavs have the top pick in the draft lottery. They have Kyrie Irving. They have Anthony Bennett that could eventually produce. They have a bunch of other players. LeBron James could be coming back to Cleveland.
It's a lot more appealing now with Andrew Wiggins there.
His biggest complaint when he was here was they didn't give him a team to play with.
Which is completely fair. I mean, they did not. Larry Hughes, that was all they brought. And yeah, I mean, getting to that point, looking at some of the Cavs' recent draft picks, if you go with the picks right after LeBron James, Luke Jackson, Booby Gibson, Shannon Brown, J.J. Hickson, Danny Green, I mean, even more recent picks, Deion Waiters, Carrick Felix, Alan Crabb. Mm-hmm. These are role players at best.
Yeah.
None of these guys are a number two. In the NBA, you need two elite players, preferably three, to win a championship. When you talk about Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen, or LeBron, Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade, that's kind of the recipe in the NBA. You need three stars.
Yeah.
And Cleveland has not had more than one star at any time. Right now, that's all they have with Kyrie Irving.
They have Kyrie Irving.
And so you're with Kyrie Irving, Andrew Wiggins, or Joel Embiid, or Jabari Parker, and LeBron, that's a championship recipe.
That's a championship sure bet, in my opinion.
It's about as sure as you can get, yeah.
And no matter who they pick, whether it's Jabari Parker, whether it's Joel Embiid, whether it's Andrew Wiggins, I don't think you can be criticized if you're the Cavs. They can be criticized for last year's draft for Anthony Bennett. No one had them as their top guy, and that kind of took everyone by surprise. And the Cavs were trying to be sneaky and said, oh, this is our guy, and we got it, and it didn't turn out great. But if they pick any of these three guys, Embiid, Parker, or Wiggins, there's going to be no criticism out of Cleveland.
That's right. We've talked about Wiggins a lot. He has the most upside probably at this point. Embiid is a 7-footer. He fills a rare role, a role most teams can't fill. Parker, he could be the sneaky number one overall. He has the best game at this point. Mm-hmm. I would if I'm playing a one-on-one game tomorrow and I gotta pick one guy against another guy, out of those three, I'm taking Parker.
Parker reminds me a lot of Carmelo Anthony, which he if he turns out to be a Carmelo Anthony type, just a pure scorer, he'll add a lot to the Cavs and he'll fill a role they really need. Andrew Wiggins kind of has a intangibles that I can't really describe.
He's got a Kevin Durant thing where he's got a killer instinct, it seems like.
Kevin Durant, he kind of reminds me a little bit of this will date a little bit, but this kind of reminds me of Vince Carter. Just with his athleticism, but with kind of like the style of Kevin Durant at the same time. Kind of a hybrid player.
A swag, as your generation would call it.
Yeah, he's kind of got a little bit of a swag. So I like the Cavs taking Andrew Wiggins. I hope they do. I wouldn't be disappointed if I see them take Parker or Embiid.
The Ohio High School Athletic Association recently passed a change to the way divisions work for high school sports.
It was coined the competitive balance issue, and it attempts to do just that, level the playing field.
Under the proposal that was approved by a majority of high school athletic directors, some schools may see their divisions change. Private schools that compete in lower level divisions because they have small enrollments maybe bumping up a division or two based on the number of students that are out of area.
And for the sake of being blunt, there is recruiting in high school sports, and it's happening at smaller private schools.
Since divisions are based solely on enrollment right now, these private schools compete with small public schools, and quite frankly, they clean house. They win just about everything, about 45% of the state championships.
And 45% of the championships where only 15% of students attend private schools.
So, Thomas, what's changing?
Divisions are going to be based on enrollment, like they always have. But a student that is not from the area of the high school or an out-of-district student who came to the school for whatever reason, sports, education, is going to be given a multiplier, adding to the total enrollment number. It will depend on the sport what the enrollment multiplier is, but essentially, if they're not from the immediate area, they're going to count as more than one student. Got it?
Not really, but we called the OHSAA Commissioner Dan Ross to give us a little more insight on the issue.
This rule will affect the placement of all of our schools into the divisions of which they would then compete for tournaments. Before this rule passed, and it doesn't go into effect until 2016-17, before this rule passed and for the next couple years, all the placements in the divisions for tournaments are made by how many youngsters walk through the front door in grades 9, 10, and 11, boys and girls. And so now this will affect the starting in 2016, we will take the number, they walk through the front door, and that's the starting point. And then you look at the roster of which sport that the youngster would be participating in, and this is in team sports. And you would look at the roster, and for a public school, you would look at, say, okay, where does mom and dad live? Or if they've been open enrolled, how long have they been there? And the third question would be then if they don't meet either the first two and they come from outside, they'll have a different weight and a different addition to that original count. This rule will affect the placement of all of our schools into the divisions of which they would then compete for tournaments. Before this rule passed, and it doesn't go into effect until 2016-17. Before this rule passed and for the next couple years, all the placements in the divisions for tournaments are made by how many youngsters walk through the front door in grades 9, 10, and 11, boys and girls. And so now this will affect the starting in 2016. We will take the number, they walk through the front door, and that's the starting point, and then you look at the roster of which sport that the youngster would be participating in, and this is in team sports, and you would look at the roster, and for a public school, you would look at, say, okay, where does mom and dad live? Or if they've been open enrolled, how long have they been there? And the third question would be then if they don't meet either the first two and they come from outside, they'll have a different weight and a different addition to that original count. If you're in a non-public school, they will be choosing a feeder for where most of their kids come from. Then that feeder would be one level. If those youngsters have been in that same system of education, that would be the level number two, just like an open enrollment youngster in a public school. And then if a youngster then is on that enrollment, on that roster, and he comes from outside of that same system or the feeder, he would be the third category.
This is the first time this issue has passed. It's been on the docket three times before. This is the first time it's passed. I understand the resistance from private school athletic directors who do not want to move up in a division so they can continue to do well in the lower divisions. But what was some of the resistance from public schools?
Well, I think originally it came from, truthfully, I think it came from the socioeconomic, the free lunch piece, because I think there were a lot of districts that were looking at many of the urban centers that would have a high free lunch count and say many of those schools have great basketball programs, and this would then take them down a division because the high number of free lunches. That was an issue. I think there was an issue with the tradition factor of saying, okay, if you're really, really successful and we've done things real well and we've been very, very successful, we may be moving up a division. I think the piece with this one that probably there were some last year in the referendum voting last year, I think one of the issues that was a concern for public schools was the number of the open enrollment kids that last year there was not the section in the middle like we have this year. It was either you live in the district or you don't. And so the multiplier last year had a much more stringent effect on public schools' open enrollment kids, the same way that had on non-public schools, because if you were in the same system of education, if you weren't in the chosen feeder, but you were in the same system of education, just that you were exacerbated your count. This year, that's been minimalized just exactly like the open enrollment piece for the public schools.
Speaking of open enrollment in public schools, I was exchanging emails this morning with Dan Garrick, the principal at St.
Francis. DeSales.
Yeah, DeSales right here in Columbus. He wrote this morning, quote, "The concept of competitive balance is certainly one that has value. However, this referendum does nothing to address the situation at the Division I level, nor does it adequately address open enrollment in public schools." Those are Dan Garrick's exact words.
With the Division I, you're absolutely correct. The Division I piece, this was never really designed to deal with Division I. We kind of worked with the Division I issue when we started with football because we added the 7th Division, which played last year, which certainly helped the Division I piece because it took the top 72 off the top and then moved the rest of the bottom end of Division I into the new Division II.
Like I said before, about 15% of students in Ohio go to a private school, but private schools win about 45 to 50% of team sport state championships. So is this competitive balance issue an attempt to even that out and, quite frankly, stop recruiting in private schools?
I think when it began, I think that your comment would be exactly correct. That I think it started with, okay, we need to try to balance this out. I don't think that's where this is morphed into or evolved into. I think it's more that when a coach is going to play a team, they want to look across the field and feel like that school got their kids the same way we got our kids. And if they did not, then there's a modification put on how they were placed in their enrollment because they got their kids in a different way.
Well, Dan, let me jump in here real quick. Will the playing field really ever be even? I mean, if you go to a school like Lima Central Catholic, where they can charge thousands of dollars a year in tuition, they have a beautiful stadium with artificial field turf, and then they're playing the likes of North Union up in Union County, who has a tiny little stadium crunched in between two cornfields. Why not go separate tournaments? That'd be the only way you could really ever be equal, right?
Well, I don't believe that the separate tournament piece, because you're going to end up probably with either two or three different tournaments. If you want to split, there's going to be schools that are going to be non-public schools, especially small schools, that probably have no desire to join a different association because they're in rural areas. They're not going to have anybody to play. Now think about your example just now. Who is Lima Central Catholic going to play if you end up with a public and a non-public association? Because you'd have to go to Sydney, maybe. That may be one.
St. Henry's?
No, St. Henry's public.
Oh, is it? I didn't know that.
St. Mary's is public.
Hmm. I didn't
know. Thinking about Sidney Lehman. That's probably the closest one.
Wherever Bobby Hoying went to high school, it's in Western Ohio.
St. Henry, that's a public high school.
Ah, I didn't know that.
But then from Lima, they're going to have to go to Dayton. Now, Lima can't compete with Chaminade and Kettering Alder out of Dayton, or they'll go to Toledo because that's the closest ones you're going to play. Most of the small non-publics don't want that at all. Now, if you're in a metro area, they certainly, because there's plenty of teams for them to be able to play. So you would probably end up with three sets of tournaments. You'd have probably for the non-public school association, they may have their tournaments. The ones that are the small rurals that want to stay in ours would be a separate tournament because you were voted in a separate tournament, but they're still members of our association.
We've been talking about recent competitive balance changes to Ohio high school sports, and we've been speaking with Ohio High School Sports Athletic Association Commissioner Dan Ross. Dan, thanks again.
You're very, very welcome.
All of those big-time high school sports programs have active booster programs, and all of that money rolling in to pay for those uniforms and other expenses can be too tempting for some.
Ohio has seen its share of booster embezzlement. The most recent case comes from Mansfield, where two boosters are charged with stealing more than $75,000 from a scholarship fund.
For more on the case and a broader look at booster oversight, we call the state's top lawyer, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine.
Well, these individuals have been found guilty and have been sentenced. And what they did was they were worked their way into a local boosters group that was called the Mansfield Tiger Booster Group, and they stole money. They stole a lot of money. They stole over $200,000 from this local boosters group that was supposed to, you know, the money was supposed to go to help the students at Mansfield, help the sports teams, and instead these people stole the money.
So the allegations are not that these were longtime do-gooders who happened to succumb to temptation by holding tens of thousands of dollars. The allegations are that these people made their way into the booster club with a specific intent of stealing money.
You know, I don't know when their intent arose, whether they had the intent before they went in or after they went in. That's not clear to me. But, you know, booster groups have a lot of cash. And, you know, they were operating with a lot of cash. And they were doing some bingo, which is really where they raised most of their money. I mean, most of the booster groups, as you know, work concession stands at football games and basketball games. But what they were doing was they had a very lucrative bingo operation going, and that generated a lot of the cash, and they stole the money.
We see these cases pop up quite a bit, and boosters for various clubs stealing thousands of dollars, even tens of thousands of dollars from parents and donors, and we see it more than, honestly, we'd like to. How much oversight is there of booster clubs in Ohio?
Well, we have increased the oversight of booster clubs. If any booster club today has over $25,000 in assets or generates over $25,000 in income, then they have to file a report with the Attorney General's office. They can go up online and they file that. That enables anybody in the community or anyplace else to look at how much money is coming in and also to, determine if there's too much overhead or if it looks like there's anything wrong. But we do not have the ability, to audit every single group. We have hundreds and hundreds of these groups that have registered. And what we do is we rely on citizens to tell us if they think there's a problem in a group. In regard to the Mansfield Tiger scandal, this was someone locally, someone who had been on the board and who reported what they thought was, very suspicious activity, and we were able to get involved and find it and then prosecute the individual. So, my message today is, most booster groups do a great job. They've got wonderful people. All they care about is kids. But every once in a while, there's a bad apple that shows up, and these booster groups are pretty easy to steal from. from because they're dealing with a lot of cash. They don't have a lot of internal controls. And so we really just depend on people in the community to kind of blow the whistle if they think there's something wrong. And we invite them to call the Ohio Attorney General's office.
But state law basically says as long as the booster club does not have more than $25,000, I don't really need to do anything to officially set up a booster club, right? I can just say, hey, I have a booster club. Give me money.
Well, I suppose you could do that. I mean, you know, you're going to eventually run into some problems with the IRS and with the state of Ohio. I mean, the proper way to do it is to set up a nonprofit group, relatively easy to do. You know, you need to file the reports then with the IRS, and you can start on your way. Now, can someone set up a group and start soliciting money? Yeah, they could. Eventually, it's going to catch up with them.
Have you pushed lawmakers to set up more oversight for booster clubs, or do you think the oversight we have now is adequate?
I think there's a balance that has to be struck between oversight and between, on the other hand, the government being so intrusive into these little groups and into these small communities that it's just, it's not worth the hassle. If government regulates to such an extent that it becomes burdensome and cumbersome, people won't do that anymore. And what we want to do is encourage people to do charitable work, encourage them to, be a part of a booster club. So we hope we strike a happy medium, requiring those that do take in a significant amount of money, they have to report it. And we do rely on, people in the community to tell us if it looks like there is a problem.
We've been talking about booster club oversight with Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine. Mr. DeWine, thanks for your time this morning.
Good to be with you. Thank you very much.
That will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can always find the show at WOSU.org and on iTunes.
You can listen to the show on the WOSU Public Media mobile app and find us on Twitter at After the Score. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.